This is a remarkable discussion that was inspired by the previous night's talk on the Nagara Sutta, where the Buddha describes his awakening in relation to dependent origination and the Eightfold Path. The topics that came up show the great insight that we've all developed together, and also it answers quite a few questions that are common in some of the confusing aspects of modern Buddhism. There is no Dhamma talk here. Our discussion lasted so long that I did not give the Dhamma talk that was scheduled, and that'll be in the next recording.
I was trying to look up the actual, because all that you teach pivots around this word ignorance, pretty much.
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
And I was trying to go back to, you know, where to find that specific usage of this ignorance in the suttas. got a little lost there.
Did you look in the Paticca-samuppada, the Bhanga Sutta?
I tried to, couldn't find a decent translation for it.
Oh, it's in the book, by the way.
Yeah, okay.
So, the Buddha starts out, his great awakening is the premise that it's ignorance is the problem, and a very specific ignorance. And so when you put everything else in context, that's what he's referring to. The same thing is when he's referring to consciousness. In the context that he's talking about, he's saying that it is our thinking that is rooted in ignorance. That he's just using the word consciousness, or the translation of the Pali into the word consciousness, to describe not some grand consciousness, but simply an ongoing thinking that is rooted in ignorance. So it could get pretty repetitive to keep saying that, even though I do in the book, that just to remind people. And so even that one phrase, I've looked for something that says, becoming rooted in ignorance. And it doesn't seem to say that anywhere,
yeah.
Although I hope to find it someday. But in the context of what he started with, ignorance, of course it's becoming more ignorant if we're continuing that process.
Mm-hmm.
So there has to, when you say something, I was just beginning to become, and you don't finish it, what is it? But if you say, I was ignorant and I was just beginning to become more ignorant, you have established the context. So I think the reason why the translators don't put it in there is you already have the context, and maybe why the Buddha never used the word.
Hmm.
He's saying, I'm talking about ignorance now.
Yeah.
And if you don't do anything about that ignorance, you're going to continue to become more ignorant. Or if you... The flowchart here has dependent origination and continued selfing. And if you don't interrupt that with something, you only continue that feedback loop and continue more suffering.
Yeah,
but if you interrupt it...
I've always gotten stuck on becoming and birth and, you know, what is where.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I was going to talk about that. Make that clear before we meditate. So I didn't really touch on this last night, maybe just a little bit. The Buddha, reincarnation was a common belief during his time, and it was portrayed in the Vedas and the Upanishads, but always in the context that you as an individual is what continues to reincarnate, life after life after life after life. An individual never changes. You're a fixed soul. And of course that goes against everything that the Buddha teaches, especially impermanence. But he doesn't say that there's no such thing as rebirth. He doesn't spend an awful lot of time on any of those subjects, by the way, either. But his teachings on rebirth reflect back on dependent origination. And it reflects back on how we progress as human beings. So, and you don't have to believe in rebirth or reincarnation to understand the Dhamma. But if you do, the right way to see it in relation to the Dhamma is that you die, you have this wonderful human life, you almost achieve awakening, but you don't quite get it, and you get trampled by a cow and you die. Bahia. And there's a transition between this physical death and another birth, right? I mean, that's how the theory goes. Nobody knows how long the period of time is between physical death and physical birth, but there's a period of time. And it could be an instant, or it could be millions and millions of years. It really doesn't matter in that case because time has no bearing. In one single life, we pass away, we die, and are reborn each and every moment. And there is a passage of time that is so quick that it's imperceptible to us. We can't, our minds can't pick it up. Is everybody following me here? So even as on a physical level, we all know that right now there's millions of cells that are dying and there's millions of cells that are being born, and that's how we sustain ourselves. I'm going to get off a little bit on the subject, but I just read an article where the scientists are now getting to understand through these the colliders and stuff that they use, and it's getting into the quantum mechanics, quantum physics, that everything is energy. Everything. And that energy transforms itself depending on consciousness, depending on the observer, between a wave and a particle. And they've proven that. They could have saved an awful lot of work and an awful lot of money and just listened to the Buddha, because he described exactly the same thing 2,600 years ago called the Kalapas. He described the underlying essence of energy that we all manipulate by our point of view and create the reality that we're living in. Scientists are now proving it. And I don't say that we need, despite a very famous Buddhist teacher, I don't think we need science to prove the efficiency of the Buddhist teaching, but it's interesting that they're now proving it. So, whether it's the brief moment between the death of this moment and the birth of the next moment for this physical life, or the death of my body and the period of time before the next body, and it won't house me, but the next body that I will have an experience in. This is going to direct, I'm glad you brought this up because it directly relates to this morning's talk. It's the period of time that we're getting hung up on now, isn't it? Because it seems longer between an observable physical death and a believed future birth, rebirth.
Well, in this feedback loop that we've established, we hung this feedback loop to the body.
Yes, to name and form.
To name and form. So, you know, I'm starting to see it now as it's like a little, you know, like a hoop running through time. It's this feedback loop then goes from death to birth.
So the feedback loop, the what we don't get is that we think the feedback loop ends at death. Mm-hmm. But if we're stuck in the feedback loop, unless we do something to interrupt that, the Eightfold Path, we simply continue the feedback loop. So when that feedback loop continues in a future physical birth, it's diluted consciousness that continues in the experience of five clinging aggregates, but it's not me that does it. Because there's no permanent self. So I'm not going to be, I die and I haven't awakened and I'm stuck in the wheel of samsara and this essence, I don't want to use that word, the consciousness that is rooted in ignorance, because that's really what it is, this five clinging aggregate thing that has no name, has no face, it's driven only by ignorance, is now forced to have another experience because the component of the clinging aggregate that supports the physical experience no longer can sustain it. But the underlying ignorance that's driving, now remember quantum physics we just talked about, the underlying consciousness that's driving the creation, the formulation of wave and particle that creates everything, has a momentum rooted in ignorance.
The law that you're referring to says energy cannot be created or destroyed. It merely changes form.
Yes. Again, the Kalapas. So, just as I have the opportunity, we talked about this last night, this moment, it holds the potential to awaken or the potential to continue further ignorance. Oh, wait a minute. That moment just passed and I missed it. Got another moment rooted in ignorance. The same is true about a wasted life, or maybe I should say a life that didn't complete the path.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing, except we don't recognize in this moment the passing away of our physical existence and the rebirth of it in this moment. Rooted in, and quantum physics will say there's no time in between wave and particle creation either. We just can't perceive it because it happens so quickly. But we can observe it, or at least we think we can, observing a physical death, cremate the body or bury it, you know, and then something else occurs at some point in the future. But it's simply the same process.
Yeah. Feedback loop picks up another model. And away we go.
And that's what's called wandering endlessly in samsara.
So then what this process is observable when we go to sleep at night.
That's a real good description of it.
We go to sleep.
Of the experience of it.
Of the experience of it. We go to sleep and we're no longer, there's no conscious reference of whoever, Matt, anymore. I'm asleep and it's gone. And then I wake up and there I am.
And you did not have to maintain a connection to the consciousness that describes Matt to still be Matt when you woke
right.
up. And again, we do that continually.
Is that because it's so conditioned?
That's conditioned thinking.
Exactly.
And remember, this whole process, this is why dependent origination is so important. And the only thing that we have to understand really about dependent origination, forget about all the links, because we can get really lost in that. And it's really not all that important, except as it relates to, well, dependent origination simply states from ignorance, suffering arises. All manner of suffering. All manner of suffering is samsara, wandering around in endless experience rooted in ignorance. No matter how wonderful that experience is, it has no real validity because it's rooted in ignorance. You can't even see it clearly. You could be a prince in a kingdom, and it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't matter because it doesn't relate to what you are. When you develop the Eightfold Path and you end ignorance and you end that process, you've ended future births, whether it's in the next moment or lifetimes,
mm-hmm.
if you want to believe it. You've ended that process of having a human life rooted in ignorance. When the Buddha awakened, you see that, he sat like, there's always a picture of him, and he's touching the ground with his right hand. And what he's saying is, I have overcome the earth and the world. And what when he describes that, he says just that. I have lived, well, he usually says the holy life, and I always change that into the well-integrated life, to mean well-integrated into the Eightfold Path. I've lived a well-integrated life. There is nothing further for me in this world. For me, there will be no further births. And that is significant. What he's talking about is there's no more potential for him to give birth to another ignorant moment, and he has ended the cycle. Now, that doesn't, obviously, he didn't die when he ended the cycle. He lived for 45 more years. But he also said that he'll never have this physical form anymore. Why? Because the physical form is dukkha. There's no reason, there's nothing compelling him, despite the myth that there's going to be a future birth of a future Buddha coming. That's always portrayed as a future Buddha coming to save us. When that can't possibly happen, can it? A Buddha can't save us. We can save us by becoming Buddha, hence the name of the book. There's no further birth for me. That's the goal for all of us, by the way. When the Buddha, I see you, Kevin. When the Buddha described suffering, how did he describe it? Birth is suffering. And from birth follows, now we're talking about the physical experience, from that physical birth comes sickness, aging, and death. Included in that process from birth to death is sorrow, regret, pain, all of that, not getting what you want, getting what you don't want. In short, again leading to the talk this morning, in short, the five clinging aggregates, the vehicle that experiences suffering, the personal experience of suffering. All rooted in ignorance. So when we awaken, we're probably going to be in about 8 or 9 minutes. When we awaken, we cannot we don't hold the potential, the possibility of giving birth to another moment rooted in ignorance. We don't hold the possibility anymore to give birth to any type of suffering, any type of confusion, any type of deluded thinking. We've ended, to use the term that's old, we've ended the fetters. What's the fetters? Greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. Greed and aversion are really two aspects of clinging, resulting in deluded thinking.
And fetters are things that bind you. I mean, you're fettered. This is basically...
Yes. Yes, you're bound to suffering. So when we develop the Eightfold Path, that was developed for the sole purpose of interrupting the ongoing process of ignorance giving rise to suffering, we have a clear and direct way of developing awakening to ending the process of giving birth to another ignorant moment or another completely ignorant lifetime. It's just a continuation that scientists are now proving that actually occurs. All, and again, getting back to that quantum physics, quantum mechanics, it's all impacted by our consciousness, by the way we think. Think about the power that's really there in our thinking. And so I'm not talking about manifestation, or what it's usually, success consciousness. Meaning that I can just think about, you know, winning the lottery and eventually I'll do it. Or creating a successful life just by our thought. Because that's just a self-referential view, isn't it? Now, I mean, it's interesting because I spent quite a bit of time very early in my developing consciousness in the success books, in Napoleon Hill, etc. Ogmandino is one of the... I was just thinking about Ogmandino this morning, a good description of conditioned thinking, and if I don't get too far off base, then we'll talk about it. We can literally create anything we want in a reasonable way. Now, remember, the physical world has its own qualities called causes and conditions. So, with my thought, I can create the most incredible life, but worldly causes and conditions might bring an earthquake or a flood, and there's the end of that. It's impermanent. What the point I'm making is, if I put enough thought into it, I may be able to create this fabulous life on the outside. But why do it? Because the earthquake's going to come, or the flood, or the famine, or just aging and death.
Or the bus comes around the corner,
or
there you go.
Or the bus comes around a corner, or the cow. So what's the sense of it? Why even put... Even if you can do it, why would you want to put that kind of energy in? Because the same energy that you might put into creating the most fabulous, incredible life that any human being ever had can be put in a simple and direct way to awaken. And then you don't got to worry about all the rest of that stuff. It doesn't matter. Why? Because you're no longer identified with worldly causes and conditions and worldly events. You don't have an identity of being a king or center field for the Yankees or anything else. And then if it happens that you become a king or the center fielder for the Yankees, or you win the U.S. Open, or you achieve anything that you might want, it's no longer has the possibility to bring suffering from loss. You're simply present with it. There's no disturbance in your mind. That's the essence of an awakened mind. When we talk about, well, I'll talk a little bit about it today, about feelings. Feelings in the general sense is not just a physical feeling or an emotional response. It's any movement in the mind that is rooted in that ignorance. Imagine that. Imagine having the power of that, having a completely peaceful mind, no matter what's occurring. And understanding the process that what you think is going to give you what you have in your life. Not in an acquisitory way, if that's even a word. Not in moving towards acquisition. What do we want? What are the reasons why people build huge houses with gates around them? So they think they can create peace and safety within at least that little spot.
This is mine. This is me.
Yeah, and it's understandable when we don't understand the process. But we can let go of the big houses and the gates and all the protectionist stuff. Imagine how the world would be different right now if we all thought that way. And just lived in peace within ourselves.
But people also think that pleasure and all that and security is what's going to give them pleasure. It's an extreme aversion to discomfort. So peace, maybe, but like enjoyment.
Oh, I get that all the time.
And I'm just saying that that's like, you know, often what people are are looking to get is the diluted way of thinking that they can keep this diluted because you can't know it thing happy. And I can keep my family happy, and I can keep myself happy.
And that becomes the goal of life.
Right.
Not getting what you want or getting what you don't want. It's all part of that. Mm-hmm. And it's all rooted in a misunderstanding of self. So those things in life...
More people were interested in peace. It might be a little different.
Yes, well, but if more people were interested in peace and understood how to create it, there's a lot of people that are interested in peace.
I know, but they're, you know, that's thinking that you can change the outside things and try to create some sense of world peace. But
We haven't had a world leader, including the present one. I'm not putting him down or singling him out. We haven't had a world leader that wasn't interested in peace. We prosecute wars to create peace. And in some situations, there's a reasonableness behind that because of the way that the conditions of the world. Mm-hmm. Why haven't we ever, and we've been trying to do this forever. Mm-hmm. How come we can't? Why can't we as thinking human beings create that utopic world that we all want? Because we haven't created it in ourselves first. Because we still think there's another, we still think even whether it's as an individual person, I can create peace in my little corner of the world as long as everybody does what I want, to leaders of nations that says, yes, I want, we're going to have peace in the world as long as, and there's the problem, that as long as is rooted in ignorance. Kevin.
Well, what Matt was saying and what Ram was saying, you know, from that initial ignorance, you know, which we are working together as a sangha to supplant with wisdom by you know, studying the Dhamma and everything. But that ignorance, you know, it has, for someone who's entering the stream, you know, you have the wisdom to sort of have the liberation in each moment to stop the births. But if there's no wisdom to supplant the ignorance, it kind of grows. And the only stopping is sleeping. Or further down the line, exponentially stacking the ignorance is death. Is a life a day wasted or a life wasted? Oh, I just lost the day. Or I lost my life. Or I lost the moment, right? We can get down to the particle of this, the actual moment, which we develop through the refined mindfulness and the concentration, the ability to see this happening.
Yes.
So it's like, you know, the body will keep doing it, whether the day ends or the life ends or whatever, but we are able to put that intention in there, and like you just said, it's what you think. So we're making that choice to think it in each moment and to stop it, the feedback loop, now. You know, I lost that moment, now I was out there, I went back, okay? And that's a beautiful process, I think.
It's incredible. I mean, it's and scientists are now proving that it's true. And I think about this on just a practical level. No matter what's occurring in your life at this moment, if your mind is at peace, it really doesn't matter, does it? Because you've created in your own mind what's most important. And then if something happens that requires your action, it'll be a mindful action rooted in wisdom. That's why I'm talking, you know, I often say that, or we're going back to the idea of the bodhisattva, that bodhisattva had that intention that we all have as human beings, to serve others, to live in harmony, yet it's lacking the wisdom of the Four Noble Truths, to act appropriately. Liz?
So just to sort of unravel it to... really simplified level, and a moment-to-moment level is to then ask yourself the question, if you find yourself in a situation where there's conflict or whatever, the question to ask yourself then is, what ignorance am I attaching myself to at this moment? And by ignorance, so the ignorance is of the Four Noble Truths, but what part of all that, maybe what piece of the Eightfold Path, and then unravel it that way. So that when feeling you can say to yourself, what piece of ignorance am I holding on to? And then sort of let go of whatever that attachment is in the moment.
Yes, and that's the only time that it can take. It can't be done in the past. Obviously, it can't be done in the future. It has to be done in the moment.
Sure.
So we need a well-concentrated mind to do that.
So that's sort of what I've been searching for in all this, is that in the heat of the moment, what is it that I can condition myself to respond to or learn to... Okay, so that what wisdom can I bring into that moment to stop the unraveling of the dependent origination? So that's really helpful. If it all comes back to ignorance, then you can use that word in your head and you can say, what ignorance? Mm-hmm. And where's the wisdom that can unravel the situation?
Yeah. So in the Panhasutta, we talk about the four appropriate questions. So I know when somebody's gaining an understanding because of the way that they're framing their questions, and there's so much insight in the question that you... Well, it's not even a question. You're making a declarative statement. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to respond to it. Because how do we do it? How do we... When we recognize that we're in ignorance, how do we come out of it? And so the Buddha's words. Be mindful of wrong view and remain in right view. Again, it's the Eightfold Path. And so when you find that you're seeing the world in a way that's disturbing to you, or maybe disturbing to others, be mindful of it and enter right view. What is right view? It's that disturbance is rooted in ignorance.
I have two pictures in my mind of this. One is that the whole dependent origination is like a path. And there are different points along the path, whether they're milestones or what, where you have the chance to get off of it or make a difference. Yeah. And I also have this image of like a Mobius strip, you know, it's like infinity.
Yeah.
And on one side are all the dependent origination things, and on the other side is the Eightfold Path. So you have to decide which side of the strip you're going to be on at that moment. So it's like there's a roadmap already there, and you just have to look at it.
Yeah, that's beautiful. That's it. That's what that flow chart says. That's what the Buddha taught. And again, we don't have to get caught up in the details of dependent origination. Those really aren't all that important. But to understand, if you're having a disturbed quality of mind in this moment, it's because you're seeing the world from an ignorant view. How do we get out of the ignorant view? It's the other side of the Mobius strip. It's the Eightfold Path.
You could also test the moment or the disturbance against the three marks of existence.
Yep.
What is this? Is this, you know, am I, it's a deluded self, a point of view? Is it or am I not seeing the impermanence of what's going on? Or am I just not seeing the reality of dukkha here? So, and with those three, you could pretty much knock out the majority.
Yeah, and that's what the first three suttas address those in a little bit more expanded way, the three marks of existence, so that we can understand it. And the way to interrupt the ongoing process of ignorance, contributing to future births of ignorance, is the Eightfold Path. I think, does everybody see that clearly?
Yeah, I think what Liz and Ram are illustrating overall is taking responsibility for what's mm-hmm. coming up in your mind.
Yeah.
Being
aware.
Yeah.
And realize what it really comes down to is what's going on in your mind. And that, so we may not get to, we're going to probably have to cut out either meditation or the talk today, and that's okay, we'll adjust the schedule. That leads to, I was thinking about Ogmandino. Does everybody know who Ogmandino is? He was a success writer, I think one of the best, but he wasn't as well read as some of the other ones, like Napoleon Hill or U.S. Anderson, etc. But if you read one of his books, you probably read every one of them, and I did. And it wasn't so much that he was writing about use these spiritual laws for success. He really had a significant message underlying this, which really was what's most important is how you live your moment-by-moment life. And so one of his books is called The Choice. And there's a line in there. He says, once you reach a level of success that you're happy with, stop. You don't have to keep going. You don't have to keep acquiring things. And think about that. Even in that, in the world that he was living in, he didn't keep saying, go, 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 keep going, keep going. Enjoy your life. So this one, this teaches...
No, some people couldn't get that message right now. Sorry. Not here. Sorry.
I don't know, what are you...
Never mind. It was inappropriate. It was just a thought. I was thinking about people that are have an unending thirst for acquisition, mm-hmm. whether it be power, material,
and it could be spiritual acquisition too. Couldn't it be?
Certainly, mm-hmm.
The world's greatest meditator.
Yeah.
So he told this story, and this teaches. This is a great example of conditioned thinking. So a cat walked into the kitchen, and it smelled some fish up on the stove. But the stove was hot. The cat jumped up, burned his feet, jumped off. The next day, the cat walked into the kitchen, and there was fish on the stove, but it was cooked a long time ago, and it was cool. But the cat wouldn't jump up there. And the cat never jumped up on the stove again because of that conditioned thinking. Something occurs to us, and we get burned. We have a... And so we'll never engage in that, whatever that situation is again. Years and years ago, I was probably 7 or 8 years old, my mom got back from her shopping, and there were 6 of us. She used to talk about how she had 2 or 3 shopping carts that she had to bring home. And she got this big bowl of beautiful blueberries. And when everybody went away, I ate that entire bowl of blueberries. And I was sick for days. And for years and years and years, well into my late 20s, I could never eat another blueberry. I couldn't stand the sight of them. And then one day, I think it was I was married, and Joanne brought home some blueberries. She says, why don't you just try it? I love blueberries today. But I missed 20 years of my life that I could have been eating blueberries because of my conditioned thinking.
I did that with
eggnog. That's a lot of blueberries.
I was like 4. I had, it was not.
No, I was going to say no.
And so we.
Tequila.
That's the essence of aversion, which is clinging to a negative reaction to the world. And it clouds our judgment. It affects. So, again, in this moment, we can let go of all of those conditioned responses and live free of that. Again, that's what the Buddha taught. The Buddha taught to do this in this lifetime. Why waste a lifetime? Take to it like his quote. Take to it like your hair is on fire, because this is the time to do it. We're so fortunate that we have a couple of days up here to be wholeheartedly engaged in it. It's an auspicious time that we have. Now I'm not just talking about this weekend. Our lifetimes are an auspicious time to awaken. We have everything we need to do it.
Why waste the moment?
Why waste the moment on other things? Now, we're going to, when it's tomorrow, Sunday afternoon, we're going to leave here and go back to the world and all the distractions and our responsibilities. And so it's understood that it's much more difficult to maintain this. That's why we have a dedicated practice that's rooted in another factor of the Eightfold Path. When we get caught up in the world and we recognize that there's an aspect of ignorance there, what do? We look to right effort. Because no matter what's going on, let's put some time into meditation and to develop the framework of the Eightfold Path in our daily life. That's why right effort is there, because it's understood that we're going to fall back into it. That's not even the right word. We're going to get engaged in the world. Can't help it.
Right effort is in the moment, just letting go of clinging to whatever it is, a sense of self. Because I think, like, when I think of conditioning, it's not, we all have these weird food things and such like that, but it's really almost more, I find, at the emotional level, things that I've gotten burned on that, I have still have those habit energies of avoiding certain things that really, carve a very narrow life because you don't want to say something because last time you got, burnt on that. And, I think as a woman in the world, not to bring in gender, but like it comes.
comes up that you don't like certain things because your opinion sometimes is not in the sangha, I'm just saying in the workplace or something.
Oh, that's true.
And you just fall into like a placid helplessness at times, or over aggressiveness or something. And so it's like just watching that very carefully and mindfully, and paying attention to what's indicated in a situation.
Yeah, you just remind me of something else that the Buddha addressed many, many years. The Buddha grew up in a very strict caste system in India that more or less still in place. And one of the things was that women weren't allowed to have anything, especially any type of spiritual teaching or participation in anything so-called spiritual. And he couldn't understand it. He was the original woman's liber. He was the first person to ever invite women into the Sangha. And there was a lot of consternation about that even in the Buddha's mind, but not because he didn't think that women belonged in the Sangha, because he was afraid, in fact he said it, he was afraid that women would simply be killed if they were given robes. And he said, no, that's wrong. Because he didn't see it. He wasn't taking up the cause of women's lib. The idea that men can achieve enlightenment but women shouldn't even have the chance, it just didn't register. And all the other caste systems, there was different levels of spiritual teachers and different levels of people that could have access to those spiritual teachers. In other words, the untouchables couldn't get any of it. You know, you couldn't go to school or church on Sunday. And even some of the middle level bureaucrats couldn't have access to the great teachers. And that was fixed in place from lifetime after lifetime. You couldn't develop in this lifetime. You couldn't work yourself out of your caste. It was impossible. That was it. That was your lot. And the Buddha said, he said in last night's talk too, this is for everyone. Everyone. And that's what he taught. He taught from the lowest of the untouchables to the greatest rulers of his time. And he didn't distinguish between any of them either. They didn't get the good guys, they didn't get the high thrones and be made comfortable. They sat like we do. That's why I said yesterday that, I mean, not that it's a caste system you have to overcome, but we're experiencing life like the first Sangha did 2,600 years ago. This is what it is. This is what they did. And they talked about stuff like this. They engaged in right speech and kept their focus on the Dhamma.
I did realize some time ago that, in a way, the Buddha did pay attention to the constraints of society at the time, because everybody was dependent on society for their food, shelter, and medicine.
Yep.
And I keep coming across references in the suttas where he basically says, no, you can't do this because we have chosen this way of being in society.
Yes.
So we have to pay some deference to those rules.
Yep.
We may not agree with it, but this is what it is. So
and
work with it.
And there's that tacit agreement that you are part of the society, you live by those certain rules.
Mm-hmm.
Again, as long as they didn't break the precepts of not killing, etc., etc. And so one of the reasons why the Buddha left the palace kingdom and stayed removed from the world in that way is to minimize his entanglements with the world. But he didn't say that you had to do that in order to achieve awakening, because he taught many people outside of the Sangha who achieved awakening. I always mention Anathapindika's monastery. That was a businessman, wealthy, who came to the Dhamma and supported the Buddha, but continued his life. King Ashoka is another great example of that. The Buddha's own father, who continued on the throne, but took to the teachings of the Buddha too. And they assumed, and he would teach rulers how to rule in the framework of the Eightfold Path. Even advising how to fight wars, because he knew he couldn't just say you can't fight, because he knew that was ridiculous. It was going to happen. How can we bring these principles even to something like that? And he taught rulers how to do that, how to fight. And what he would say basically is, you're likely to win because you're more powerful. When you win, treat the people that you conquer with dignity and grace and all the rest of that stuff. Treat them from an awakened mind, knowing that the initial aggression is inevitable. So,
and don't create more karma.
Yes.
Because it'll come back to you.
Yeah. Yeah.
In a very direct way.
Yeah. So even in any role, it's applicable too. And again, think about that. If we could bring that into the world, maybe we can. You know, I'm going to send my book to Trump and to Putin and see what happens.
I'll sign the letter that you accompany.
I may do it. I mean, you never know. But
why not?
I'm just full of myself enough to think it.
I think you have to make it a video. I don't think he reads. I think he just watches television.
Well, can we break it down to tweets?
Sure. I got wow.
Actually, start at the beginning and start to read.
I think you would. I think the system would crash.
So,
well, actually, now you could probably sum it up in one tweet from ignorance. Comes all.
Yeah,
but
then you have to have
subtweets. Well, but see, the problem, you're right, it should be that simple, but the problem is that, and I'm not talking about Trump, from ignorance, tell the world, guess what? From ignorance, all suffering arises.
Mm-hmm. They're going to take
people,
it personally.
Well, they're either going to take it personally or say, yeah, that's true, all those ignorant people are creating a problem. Because you have to ignore ignorance. And that happens a lot, and I'm not just talking about Trump. When you hear the rhetoric, the extreme rhetoric on the extreme both sides, they're basically saying, it's everybody else, you're all wrong.
Confirmation bias.
But I'm confirmation bias, but I'm right. Everybody else is ignorant. So the great democracy of the Buddha was, everybody's ignorant, and I was once too.
I find it interesting that the Buddha came from India that was entrenched in the system of caste systems, exacerbating the pain and suffering that existed in the world.
Yeah.
So he came from one of the most long-suffering areas for the human condition, and was able to develop this.
Yeah.
And when you talk about, you know, Buddhism in China, and I mean, they were brutal to each other.
Yeah.
You know, and Taoism and Buddhism,
yep,
and Confucius, they were all a core part of their culture.
Right. Well, there was no hiding the suffering. That's why.
There was
it's
no
clear.
What?
There was no hiding the suffering.
Yeah.
Here we can kind of gloss it over.
And I wonder
how we live in our communities and
we
don't see the real suffering that goes on.
Mm-hmm.
There,
well,
it's right in your face.
I think coming from his protected and privileged life, the suffering was more obvious. Whereas if you grew up in it, you would sort of accept a certain amount of suffering as normal. Everybody else goes through it.
Because you're conditioned to it.
Yeah, exactly. So that he had the clarity to see that none of it was necessary.
Yeah, I want to talk about that in a second, where that clarity came from. But you had another comment,
yeah,
I think.
How would you teach, if we were going to inner city Trenton, and working with a group of people from a more difficult environment economically or mental health or whatever, how would you teach? Would you teach it any different?
Boy, what a great question. Mm-hmm. Not really any different. So the Ratana Sutta is the answer to that. The Buddha was called into a town that was devastated by natural disasters and disease that was flowing from that. The first thing he did is he attended to the physical needs, what needed to be taken care of. So you go into an inner city situation, what are the problems? It's extreme poverty, it's addiction, it's violence. You address those first. And to me, the way to address it is a forum. You know, you talk and get people talking. I think that's the biggest problem. That's why we have such a hard problem solving these issues, because we forget that we can talk about it instead of trying to force something. And then in that situation, the Buddha did this. He took care of the needs of the I can't remember the name of the town. And then he said, this is how you develop lasting peace and happiness in your life. And he taught them the Dhamma. He taught them the Four Noble Truths. It's an incredible teaching that's still valid today, isn't it? So you got me thinking about something that I forget what it was. What were you saying?
About how he had clarity of vision.
Yes.
Contrast.
Yes, yes, yes. So now I'm getting back and forth. So it's, I don't think you could go into Trenton and say the solution to your problem is learn to meditate and develop the Eightfold Path. But you introduce it in a different way. People know what meditation is. And I think the people's biggest resistance to it is they think that it's something other than what it is, simply developing concentration. When I teach young kids, every now and then I get a young kid that, you know, thinking about this guy, I used to call him Little Buddha. He stopped coming, but I teach them about right speech this way. I said, do you notice when you're talking about your friends with your other friends in a hurtful way that you don't feel good? And invariably, kids will say, yeah, I really don't feel good. I said, well, why do you do that? And this kid came back the next week. He says, you know, this whole week I never talked about a friend like that. In practical ways. I get into conceptual stuff probably too much myself. Kids aren't going to respect or aren't going to respond to that. Young adults aren't going to respond to the concepts. But you can, if you point, how does it affect your life? Even in an inner city conflict, you know, kids are fighting kids. Gangs are against gangs. Where does it come from? Because it builds up the rhetoric of right speech or wrong speech between people. Explain to them. Look what your words are causing. And your words are leading to these actions. And why does it get that way? Because you think that you need to be in order to protect yourself. And I'm thinking, you know, trying to get into a mind of an inner city youth. Never had that, but you feel threatened all the time, don't you? And what do you do to take care of that threat? You threaten other people. Point out that it's from that view that you think you need to threaten other people to protect yourself. You're introducing a way of looking at the world differently that is never introduced. Well, I shouldn't say never because I don't know every social program. Most of the social programs start out with, you poor, poor dear, look at what a mess you are. Instead of giving them another way of looking at their situation, another way of talking, another way of recognizing right speech, giving them a little bit, you know, try meditating for a couple minutes a day. Imagine if we got the Crips and the Bloods meditating for a few minutes each day and looking at why they're doing the things. None of those people, and I don't mean it that way, nobody stuck in that situation can be happy about it. But they don't know any other way. Why? Because they're conditioned. That's all that you know because of that environment. The Buddha grew up, just getting back to, the Buddha grew up in the palace. He had everything anybody could ever want. And when he finally walked into town for the first time, he saw the competitiveness. He saw the caste system. He saw sickness, aging, and death for the first time. He saw an old man dead on the side of the road. He couldn't understand it. But that the contrast between his life of luxury, that extreme life, that extreme view, and the view of suffering in the world so shocked him that he said, I got to find, if there's a way to understand this and bring this to cessation, I got to spend my life doing it. And he left the palace grounds. He had to do it under the dark of night because he knew his father wouldn't let him go, peacefully anyway. And for 6 years he studied and he practiced and he developed his whole understanding of why extreme views aren't the answer. And he came up with a middle way, the Eightfold Path that allows us to be a human being, even in the inner city, but create a different view of what's occurring here to end that ignorance. And I know I say that a lot. Every time I recount the story, I guess I never get tired of my own words, but every time I recount the story, it's remarkable to me. And it's remarkable in its simplicity. Forget about the five clinging aggregates, dependent origination, all that stuff. My problem is ignorance of what's going on. I simply don't understand it. How do I understand it? Develop an Eightfold Path. Learn how to develop a concentrated mind so I can maintain that refined mindfulness of an Eightfold Path. And then I can change myself. Then I can bring peace to myself. And if I can do that, I have a little bit of a chance to bring peace to other people. But if I don't, how could I? And I'm not talking that we're violent. But if my mind is lacking understanding and it's agitated, It's constantly distracted. How can I help anyone? All that I can do is try to push a view on other people then. We should all be... Why can't we all just get along? You know, that was, that Rodney King was right to ask that question. He just didn't understand why. Maybe he was asking that sincerely. What's the problem here? Why can't we get along?
He was asking it sincerely.
Yeah.
If you listen to the tape.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it took extreme suffering to bring him to that point. What's wrong here? Mm-hmm. We're ignorant. That's what's wrong. And that's not a big thing. It's not a bad thing. It's just a thing. It's just something that it's a condition to deal with. It's the originating condition that all the other conditions are dependent on to end up in suffering. Why can't we all get along? Because we don't know how to. Because we think we've got to protect and promote this thing called the self that is impermanent. There's nothing there. It's like foam on the water.
One of the results is that it creates inequities in a society.
Yeah.
And there's a John McCutcheon song about how an empty hand soon turns into a fist.
Yeah.
If you don't have what you need, then you have to fight, and that's when it all falls apart.
And you think about where that came. I mean, that started from caveman time.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of groups, maybe they were a little taller, a little quicker, a little stronger, and they were able to get a few more animals.
Mm-hmm.
They were now better than those other poor fools.
Mm-hmm.
And those other poor fools now had to go to the stronger or smarter people to get, you know, a little bone. And so now I'm this is me. I'm now ruling people. I got people doing what I want them to do. I'm not going to give that up for anything. Even though now you're separated. Now the other cavemen that came out of the woods, they're not going to take that anymore. They're going to just take what you have. You got to start building walls. You got to get bigger rocks, and you got to learn how to throw them quicker and more accurate. That's why we're still living in those times, aren't we? Because of an ignorant view of life. Instead of just saying, you know, boy, there's a lot of lions and tigers and bears that everybody can eat. Help yourself. And controlling things.
But there isn't. In some places, there simply isn't.
Well, yeah, but there are. That's true. But just beyond something, so those places, there is. In other words, there's no real lack in the world. It's because of a process of supply and demand, which is a process of control. And so, yeah,
I would say that even in the time of the Buddha in India, there was not enough. The resources were already constrained, and the issue was more the relentless need to procreate than...
No, well, you're right.
You know, which and, is maybe...
And there's an aspect
why,
of restraint there too, isn't there?
Yeah.
There should be.
Why lust is always pretty high on his list of things to avoid.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's part of the precepts too, sexual misconduct.
Mm-hmm.
And so what he's saying by it is don't abstain from sex. That's not what that means. It means to use it wisely, generously,
mm-hmm.
and certainly not
for the pursuit of
not through infidelity.
Mm-hmm.
Because if what he's saying is that if you just, you know, take care of your home and stay with your wife, or wife stay with your husband, you're not likely to start creating a whole bunch of kids out there that have no connection to anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's natural population growth, a natural population growth inhibitor that way.
Yeah.
Because if you're responsible for your family and you got three kids, and you're well focused on that's the only place you're gonna engage in sex, you're probably gonna be much more careful about having kids. But you're not responsible for it.
Right. But I remember his saying of comparing the world to a drying puddle in the road with little fish in it, all trying to stay alive.
Yeah.
Yes, that's the one thing he said we all have in common is we all eat.
Yeah.
Each other.
Yeah, that's sustenance. That's another talk. But again, even there, he's describing the nature of dukkha.
Mm-hmm.
It is. We're in a puddle that's doesn't have a lot of fish and it's drying up. And that's just the case. What's the solution? Is to stop coming back here. I mean, it's just what we start our talk with. Stop. Get off the get out of samsara and stop creating the conditions that are, if you believe that, are binding you to coming back into this existence that is just a drying up puddle.
The positive feedback loop is what you said earlier, which is if dependent origination manifests itself, question the ignorance, deal with the ignorance, and move into a more positive way of being. And then
yeah.
What is the element of dependent origination that's arising? What is the ignorance that it's pinpointing, or what is it? What is the ignorance that's the fire? And then deal with that ignorance and create a more positive.
Yeah. Can we say more awakened?
Yeah,
more awakened than positive.
And
more awakened than positive, because positive has a judgment in a sense. Mm-hmm. No,
yes. I mean, no, you're right. Yeah, I mean.
But it's, you can see Helen pictures things. I feel things. So I've been trying to find that answer to when I feel this. This relates to that. That I can deal with and resolve and stop and move into a different place. And then the wisdom is knowing, the wisdom is the answer to, obviously the answer to the ignorance, but so if I go in this direction with this feeling, then I don't know, it just gives me a way to define things so that I can bring them into the phenomenal world and deal with them.
Yeah, and again, that's the framework of the Eightfold Path.
I can go home
and
now.
You can. And again, you're taught, it's not, being in the world is prone to sickness, aging, and death, and all the rest of it. But that doesn't describe the experience of an awakened human being, because now you are no longer touched by those things. You live a life, moment by moment, of peace and happiness, fulfillment. And then whatever happens, pardon me?
Well, I said, but until then, you have a way of getting out of that loop.
Yes.
Until you actually get there.
And
don't go enter that loop.
That's
anymore.
The integration.
And there's nothing, I think, there's nothing more important than doing that and doing it like your hair is on fire. Mm-hmm. Jen, you had a question?
I was just going to comment on something Liz said when she was talking about being in the heat of the moment. Kind of what to do and where to go with that. And I just wanted to share that in my experience, if I try to go anywhere, I'm already off the path.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Even if it's into the Eightfold Path, even if I'm thinking about the Eightfold Path, I'm avoiding sensing and being with whatever's coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the Eightfold Path, it's just more of a pause and an interrupting experience of reacting to the situation that I'm in that is causing my agitation. So rather than trying to think about the ignorance or to think about how it's related to the Eightfold Path, just notice that I am having a sensation and stopping with that. And that's kind of right view to me. I'm not saying it's not, anything else is not right. I'm just saying that my experience has helped, that's helped me kind of. Does that make my sense?
You have already developed the framework of the Eightfold Path to see what's occurring in a broad way, in that in that moment. You recognize that there's a disturbance in your mind.
When I'm lucky, yeah.
And again, remember how the Buddha taught to how to integrate this though. To when you recognize that you're in wrong intention, be mindful of it, and enter. The words that we use with enter and remain in right intention. It means to remember what right intention is. To recognize that in this moment, there's some craving and clinging that's occurring, and I want to. It's not John Haspel saying you should do it. It's not the Buddha saying. It's not your sangha. I want to awaken. I'm going to abandon craving and clinging in this moment. Getting back to when the Buddha in the Nagara Sutta, I recognized when I was in this. What did he do? I simply abandoned it. Mm-hmm. There was no, and I'm not saying you weren't even alluding to this, but I'm saying there's no process in it. You might have to do it over and over again because of conditioned thinking. Mm-hmm. You might find yourself right back in that mind state a moment later. Mm-hmm. And that's another opportunity. It's an auspicious moment. I'm back here again.
Yeah.
My intention is to let go of these things. Or if using right speech again, when you develop a certain level of concentration, you know when something's coming out of your mouth that you really don't want to say, and hopefully you have the restraint to do it. That's a practical application of the Eightfold Path. I do not want to engage in when you're mindful of wrong speech, and to remain in right speech. And so at that instant, you might just not say anything. You might hold back. That's integration. And that, to use Liz's words, you're recognizing the ignorance of saying a lie or something like that, or engaging in gossip. That's rooted in ignorance. But you don't have to, how you develop the path is personal. So recognizing ignorance is important to Liz.
Yeah, yeah.
For you, it's simply recognizing the disturbance in your mind. And boy, this leads to, I'm not trying to ignore you more, but this leads to something too. There's some people that hear dependent origination and immediately it has an impact on them. And there's some people that it has no usefulness at all and it's difficult to understand. But as long as you understand it's ignorance that leads to all manner of suffering, that you don't need the rest of it. Mm-hmm. That's the difference. So there's a framework for the path, but it's a broad framework. And again, this is why the Buddha called it a middle way, because it keeps us focused from those extreme views that we might have. It allows us to be individual human beings, because we are, in this sense, we are. This is the difference between the teaching that we're all one and interdependent and interconnected. Quantum physics will prove that we are, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about individual conditioned minds. So we have individual experiences of the path, but it's the same path.
I got you.
So I'm sorry, Maureen. I didn't mean to.
No. I was just going to say, I can't remember exactly now how Jen said it, but often, so we'll say, oh, that's agitating my mind, and it's not. Our mind is agitated, and that's what you're saying, right? That's what we need to recognize. It's not the condition that's agitating my mind. I'm projecting my agitated mind on some cause.
It's your conditioned mind that's creating the agitation.
That's exactly it. You know, and that those states and vagueness and feelings and all are moving around, and we just try to somehow fix it, meaning locate it somewhere. And the most important thing is just to go, agitation.
And that's the
and I can stop, you know, I can now change the direction of delusional thinking versus awakened thinking. And that's why I was just saying that in terms of saying positive and negative. I understand. I totally get your point. But that can also have its own little edge of, you know, selfhood. Of like, I want to be positive. I want to be good. But I know that's not what you're saying.
Yeah, that's not what I was saying.
Yes, I understand that. But
I think it's two sides of the same coin.
But we're talking about awakening here, so that's why I was just clarifying. Sometimes for me, I need to say, is this a delusional or an awakened state?
Yeah.
And very well all of these things are happening in impermanence. You know?
Right.
All of these things are arising and passing away on their own. An agitated mind, a not agitated mind. An ignorant thought, you know, something
it's like the moment of choice. So I have a choice in the moment to continue in ignorance or recognizing ignorance and move towards awakening. And however you need to do that, whatever works for you to get
yeah.
there is...
Yeah. Within the within that broad framework.
Yeah.
Right.
It's you know,
I almost didn't say it because when you call on me, I pause because I didn't want it to sound like I was somehow saying.
And I'm not taking it. And I'm not taking it that way.
So you were seriously considering right speech at that moment.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just
doing
remarkable.
Exactly what we're talking about.
Yeah. I mean,
and
it really is.
It's going to come up differently for
sure.
Different people. I did not.
Yeah.
Take any of it personally. So.
Yeah. Wow.
But I like hearing about how, you know, because I know Helen often references things in terms of, you know, images and pictures in her mind, and for me it's the physical thing that arises.
The fire.
Pardon?
The fire.
Yeah. So of course we're going to deal with it differently, because Helen's coming from a picture point of view, I'm coming from a fire point of view, or just an arising. So of course we're going to. It's different medicine for different, you know.
Maybe same problem, different solution.
So we take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, and this is the perfect example of what that means. We're supporting each other in this whole thing, and we're sharing our personal experience of developing the Dhamma. And we're not here talking about all kinds of other things that we could be talking about that are really just distractions. When we started the retreat with that, but the rules of the first Sangha was when you're gathered as a Sangha, you talk about the Dhamma, keep it focused, keep it framed by that. Why? Because that's how we change our thinking. And when we change our thinking, quantum physics has proven that we change our entire existence. So, we're not going to have a talk today. I was going to switch the sequence of talks and talk about the Fena Sutta this morning. I'm not going to. And I may just leave it as it was, but I may decide that I want to do that this afternoon before the Four Noble Truths. The Fena Sutta touches on dependent origination again, but it gets into the five clinging aggregates, and I think it explains it very well.